Yes, I have a number I'd like to follow up on. Thank you. Just paragraph 10.7 of your evidence. You've raised the issue of needing to define what works mean. I wasn't quite sure whether that added more complication or not, but as I understand it, let's say if you think of a building like Williams Cottage, which I think is used as like a craft shop, and I assume that's a permitted activity in that zone, is your concern that without having that definition, that the status of the activity, commercial activity undertaken in the building could come into question? Because I normally would have thought that that wouldn't come into question unless the activity which would affect heritage would be like pulling off wallpapers, pulling the wall apart, things like that, not the actual use of the building itself. But do you still think there is this need to have this differentiation?
The use itself is dealt with through the underlying zoning provisions.
Yep.
Where you can make that assumption. I guess the concern with the word works, or works including certain things, was what is works and it includes. So in this instance, I mean, the actual law I'm talking about there, you know, and it's in regards to things happening in the setting. Works including earthwork, signage, lighting, street furniture, building structures. Because it's open-ended. I know one example where someone was looking at this, well, I guess I better look at tree planting and landscaping and what was works. It wasn't definitive as to what actually was going to trigger the rule. So, yeah, to answer your first question, the land use itself, I didn't even think to myself that that might include works, but I had a concern that either the use of the word works or development, if it wasn't somehow defined, people were left wondering what the activity actually was that triggered the consent.
Okay. In paragraph 19.8, sorry, it's a little bit scattered back and forth here, my apologies for that, but the issue was raised about do not consider this issue to include the words inappropriate before the words land use, subdivision and development. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but normally I understand normal section 6 maps as they relate to heritage, and it's a bit like landscape. Correct me wrong, but I think it does use the word inappropriate.
Yes, it does.
I guess the concern I have about that is whether it might be interpreted as trying to fetter the operation of the Act in a wider sense, and it would be safer to stick to the wording.
That's not the intention. I think, as I've tried probably rather clumsily to explain, by virtue of the fact that the adverse effects were of an inappropriate scale, then that would render the land use subdivision development inappropriate. So one way of reading it, you're sort of almost doubling up by putting the word inappropriate in, but you're quite right that that's what Section 6, the terminology it uses.
But perhaps we've had this discussion with Ms. Scott and Mr. Winchester in previous hearings as to the use of the word inappropriate and the Supreme Court's decision, King Salmon decision, and I think Ms. Scott, it would be helpful in reply if you could just assist the commissioners by explaining what that word means in terms of the King Salmon submission, and so that we're consistent in our deliberations through all the various streams.
Yes,
The next question I'd like to ask is, it arises from your paragraph 20.4, which relates to this issue of consultation and owner approval prior to items being included on the list, which I guess raises a broader issue of consultation. Now, we became aware that Heritage New Zealand have sought various changes to the plan, as you're aware, and in the cases where they've sought either new listings or upgraded, they've written to the owners and said, hey, this is what we're seeing, and this is what the implications are. Now, from the council's perspective, with its own proposed upgrading, are the owners were they made aware? I'm not saying that they need to have their permission, but were they aware that what the consequences were of having their buildings upgraded?
I wasn't involved in that part of the process, so it's something we'll have to come back to you on as to whether they received individual letters as well as the normal public notification process of the district plan, and the extent to which the informal consultation occurred before that notification. Certainly, in terms of a large number of the items that were rolled over, those that came from Plan Change 3, back in sort of 2005-2007, I realise land ownership sort of, some would have changed in that time, but they certainly were consulted at the time.
Well, as you touched on it in your report, because certainly you lied to the issue, you said, well, I'm aware that there are some people out there who may or may not.
Yeah,
they don't appear to have responded.
Yes, and that's in relation to new items that original submitters have sought be added. And it was heartening to see that Heritage Centre had written those letters, so that covered certainly at least one of the items that was a brand new item brought through submissions in Gratuity Cottage. And they have certainly... They had received that. They had received receipt that they were noticed, they had received the letter from Heritage New Zealand, that they submitted that their item be listed, and they presumably chose not to do the submission on that. So I'm assuming the owners are aware of the fact that it's been listed. And thinking about it, my understanding is that the new items that were added in the PDP, that the owners were consulted on that. That's my understanding, but we can confirm that to you.
Yeah, that's. Because I'm not suggesting that owners should have a right of veto. It was more a question of being aware of what the implications were.
This question I'd like to ask relates, and it comes from my background involved in the Christchurch issue. I understand this is an issue of seismic strengthening. Was that considered through this process? One of the reasons I ask that is I'm aware, correct me if I'm wrong, but the government is now requiring buildings that are used for certain purposes, it might be commercial or residential or such like, they've got to be a minimum code specification. Now, I imagine that some buildings might not meet that at the moment. It may not be a problem for an old Staples because they don't have anybody working in them or doing anything at the moment, I'm not sure, but is that... I couldn't find any reference in either the objectives or policies as a rule to that particular issue. Is it something that you just assume would come under alteration?
There is a policy in relation to earthquake strengthening. Because you, I'm sort of thinking of somebody. This one here is 26.5.4.3. I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but that's really the only direct reference to earthquake strengthening, and I'll read it out as amended, enable and encourage ongoing improvements to particular features, including earthquake strengthening and other safety measures, in recognition that this will provide for their ongoing use and longevity. So, and that's the policy under the GP, historic heritage features are enhanced where possible. Presumably that would come into play if you're applying for an alteration or even a partial demolition that might be non-complying, and this policy may come into play in terms of something to assist that application if it's part of the project, at least as earthquake strengthening. But yeah, that's the only reference and provisions that assists.
Just following on from there, in terms of, again, coming from the Christchurch situation, sometimes, I know some of you older stone buildings around the district, there's concepts of deconstruction and reconstruction. Again, do you see those as part of alteration? Because in some cases they could be very extensive. And I was thinking when we went out to Threepwood and we looked at the old stone stables there, which I think is just basically stones packed on each other. Primary difference from that and demolition, of course, the demolition you just put a bloody great bulldozer through it, pile it all up into a truck and take it to a landfill, whereas deconstruction means carefully dismantling it and reconstructing it, possibly in a slightly different form to give it greater seismic performance. But
Thinking about that, and maybe you need to go away and think about it a bit more, is that concept something you think could be is going to be adequately addressed through the rules? In other words, would that be facilitated, if I could use that word?
I'm just trying to think where that would sit in the rules. It doesn't clearly fit. It's not militant.
I think
it would be operational.
The
result would be a minor maintenance and repair. There's a lot of process that goes on.
Would it need a specific provision? It
wouldn't be minor. So it's not specifically acknowledged, and yet it would probably be.
I guess the main thing I was thinking of here is that I would imagine the council would like to see a situation. You look at the old three-foot stables, which are in quite a bad state, and it looks to me, to fix them up, you are going to have to do some fairly drastic stuff to the thing. This basis to make sure that the plan in its final form facilitates that. Obviously, in a way that takes account of its heritage values, you don't want some sort of plastic copy of the original, but that would facilitate that kind of work being undertaken, particularly to old stone buildings, so that they survive into the future.
Just in thinking about some of this, the policy idea 26.5.1.5, and that's in terms of both demolition and relocation. We do talk about the risk to safety, human safety, and right of state and non-compliant activities exempt for a Category 2 building to be demolished, or for a Category 1 or 2 to be relocated, Category 2 to be relocated off the site. That's an issue that we would like to look at through the policies as to whether we should do so. We would obviously, be a reason for potential granting the demolition of it. Or the relocation or whatever, if it was to improve public safety. So that's the sort of terminology used there. The feature of problem is at risk to safety. And that's slightly different issues if that's reaching about being a reason to demolish.
Thank you. Earlier this morning, Commissioner Nugent made mention of about alternatives like the ability to maybe dispense with parking requirements or things like that as an incentive. At one point in your report, I can't quite exactly where I saw it now, but the issue came up of whether the council would offer heritage grants, or they take two forms normally. One is normally providing advice and assistance, which is free, or providing financial assistance. Does the council actually have, like Christchurch and Auckland cities, does it actually have a budget, however modest, to help?
Yes, it does. So that's been active for a few years, and it's the heritage. I can't find the section for you if I could. It's a footnote. But yes, it does. So I think it's page 44 if you want to look at it. The grant is available to assist individuals financially with professional advice, consent, and maintenance in relation to listed heritage items. Comment held in modest. The council allocates $25,000 annually to the scheme to support heritage projects in the district. Over the last 4 years, a number of applications have been lodged, and the council has not had to decline any application due to insufficient funds. That's an answer to that one. It does have a heritage incentive grant and a public brochure, and people to an extent at least know that it exists.
Yeah, but I know Christchurch City does trumpet the fact in the plan. The fact that they see that as a major, like Section 32 counterbalancing thing, so they will provide funding. Now, obviously, the budget there is a lot bigger than Queenstown, but nevertheless, it's probably something worth.
It's not in the provisions anywhere. There's a structure, we don't have a sort of other methods section, just where it would perhaps normally sit and highlight to people.
Just on that point. Does the council charge full consenting fees for applications under
Chapter 26? In terms of current practice,
that's another incentive.
It's
a disincentive charging them. Mm-hmm. Incentive is not charging them.
I only know from my experience as a previous trustee at the Waterford Heritage Trust when the trust applied for consent to refurbish the Arashan jail. And in that instance, I'm sure the fees were waived.
And was that by Lakes Environmental or the council? Or Civic Court?
It would have been by council. It was recently, last year. But I don't know if that, that may well have been a one-off, and that the council actually owns, it's all very complicated, the ownership of that particular property, but council and the Queenstown Lakes Museum, District Museum, have partners in that, so that may have had a bearing on that particular project.
Okay, stepping back from the council's policy, as a planner, do you think there are any benefits in those sorts of waiving of consenting fees and providing modest budget or whatever?
Yeah, certainly. Yes, I mean, the owners of heritage buildings are providing the public good to the wider community. So if possible, I think it should be acknowledged.
Because I think the theme that's come to a few of the questions this morning is that, just taking purely on the face of it, the plan does seem to have quite a strong emphasis on regulation. And with Section 32, it says that the lease is a partly counterbalancing system of incentives and other matters which can help soften the blow.
Yes, and in terms of your question, which I responded to about the relaxation of rules, the way I saw that happening was through the other parts of the plan, just in terms of the structure of this district plan. For example, so transportation isn't in this part, isn't in stage one of the review, it's in stage two, and I'd certainly be trumpeting that there is an objective and policy in here that talks about the relaxation of other provisions where possible in order to correct that imbalance. And so that is where that would sit, in terms of, say, car parking dispensations. We sit there, when the subdivision rules are considered, it's considered that any dispensation can be made in terms of subdivision or unit title in the heritage buildings. So I see them sitting, I don't think there's a very complete picture here, but I see them sitting in those individual and in the land use section, for example, the needing allowed retail in a heritage building where it otherwise wouldn't allow retail to occur.
Is that already in those other sections? I don't recall anything in the rural section, that is.
No, not that I'm aware of, but I'm only familiar with a couple of sections.
The provisions in the Auckland Dismiss Plan that I looked at over the weekend, and I have to concede it's one I'm the most familiar with in terms of heritage items, it's relevant. Provides a separate set of assessment criteria for all applications in any zone on a heritage item that replace the assessment criteria that would apply otherwise for the activity. And that is contained within the heritage section, so one understands immediately that a heritage building is in a different situation. And I'm wondering whether the scattering stuff through various parts of the plan, it's sort of like these links in the back of evidence that hides it from the people who are most concerned.
Yeah, no, I accept that. And in principle, I definitely support the relaxation of other provisions where possible to promote heritage protection.
The next question I was going to ask was related to, again, came out of our site visits, and we visited a number of places where the building interiors had obviously been substantially modified. The house in Brisbane Street, the sort of stone cottage on the front, is one example of that. It looks like it's been turned into a modern interior from what we can see.
Right.
Another example was the former Methodist Church in Arrowtown. I'm just wondering, in terms of knowledge of building interiors, which became a bit of a battle in the Christchurch hearings, we had a rather interesting discussion with the elderly gentleman who owns Arcadia, I presume he's the owner of Arcadia,
What do we know about the interior of Arcadia, particularly given the public doesn't have access to it?
Yes, you may be best, I don't know if you can now that it's not off the stand as it were, but you may be best to ask him in terms of, I personally haven't got in depth in terms of the ins and outs of the heritage assessments and the information that exists on every item. But I think in a nutshell the information on interiors is it's not thorough, it's not comprehensive to the point that we can actually identify which interiors we want to protect and which ones we don't.
Okay.
Like some plans, are at that point and can do that. We can be specific about which interiors are protected and which aren't.
So at the moment, the only way if someone's carrying out works on the interior of a building would be the definition of heritage fabric. So you basically have to go into the building and say, well, this is fabric, this is
that's right. Fabric. And you may say there is no heritage fabric internally. We're changing 100% of the interior, but none of this heritage fabric.
Just two more questions. The first one, just basically educating me, really. Heritage landscape, thinking of Mount Judah. Tungsten mining, obviously these guys have got a mining licence. Can you tell me what the interface is between the Mining Act and the RMA and the District Planning? I presume the mining licence means they don't need consent to remove, basically entitled to take the tungsten out of the ground. Does that override any of the planning provisions?
I presume not, but I'd have to say I'm not familiar with the Mining Act myself either.
So I'd like to pursue that question, but from a legal perspective, it's something you can have a look at the end. But I think it's important to be clear about that.
And I can only assume it doesn't trump the district plan provisions in the manner that was, they are doing to ensure they've got as much permissibility as possible for the district plan. But I'm not familiar with the act, I'm afraid.
My final question just relates to what you've mentioned in your evidence. I think someone thought adding the word enhancing to the word to where you're referring to heritage.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm asking a question about that is in the Christchurch scenario with resource consents, sometimes the word enhancing has been a bit of a problem because the reporting officers will say, well, okay, you've still got the same building at the end of the day, so you haven't really enhanced anything. Do you think there would be value in actually perhaps explaining somewhere or some way in the plan what enhancing actually means? It could mean like seismic strengthening, it could mean repairing damaged fabric, restoring original fabric, something of that nature, so it makes it clear what enhancement actually means. And otherwise it's one of those sort of can mean a lot of things words.
Yes, that could be useful, particularly people decide they want to use that to try and argue whether putting a lower maintenance modern roofing type on the building is enhancing it because it's actually going to make it more weathertight, so it would probably be useful to clarify what we mean by enhancement in terms of heritage terminology.
Okay. I'd just like to commend you on a very detailed, thorough report. It's very helpful. Thank you. Other than that, no further questions.
Can I just say, Ms. Dodd wanted me to just highlight in terms of responding to other people's evidence, and it was just in terms of this issue of expensive plates and the fact that the maps aren't of high quality, and I accept that in my own Section 42A report, I make that comment. And Ms. Gill has mentioned it in her evidence, so I just want to have it on the record that I agree with that, and the purpose of having them there was to I guess to see where there was acceptance and principle of that concept, which I think is where we need to be at some point. And if so, the council would have resource to improve those plans, not within the time frame of the right of reply, but before a notified decision came out, for example. So I'm not clear whether you're in a position to give any indication before that, but if that was something you're interested in pursuing,
So did you agree with Mr. Knox? When I asked him to define that, he said a extended place means a setting which is physically defined on the plan?
It's more definitely defined, and it's usually planned or put in text very clearly what it is, so that you've got more certainty, more certainty than if you just rely on settings. So it's an approach that's been taken in Auckland, for example, and supported by your concerns.
Well, just following on from that, the information that you've Scott handed up this morning in response to our minutes in the title of the draft, Queensland Lake Circuit Register.
Mm.
Are these details incorporated in the plan by reference?
No.
Would there be value in somehow referencing this material? Because it seems to me that if there's a plan defining the extent of the place that's within this material, that's the appropriate place to do it, isn't it? Rather than have a whole series of maps and plans in the construct plan.
Yeah, and including this by reference. In terms of the structure of the plan, district plan, particularly if the long-term view was that we would get as many expensive places identified as possible over time.
Mm.
I was
just thinking all the other information in here too is relevant to the listing. The listing doesn't tell you what the significance of the item is.
No, and that was the purpose. That's right, and that was the purpose of having these.
Mm.
Was that as a starting point for the processing planner and the applicant to understand why is it listed, and even though the district plan may not have got to the point where it's telling you that the interior is important, hopefully when both parties read this, they're like, oh, okay, obviously the interior has a lot of value, so that is going to be fundamental to this resource consent application.
I just quickly read the one for Arcadia that didn't seem to mention the interior, but I didn't read all of it. Well, it went on to several pages, so I didn't have a chance to read all of it. But, okay. Now, just in terms, before I go into the section 42A report, I've got some questions about the plan provisions as you have recommended. I'm just wondering whether your objectives and policies are in the right place. It seems that you have a purpose, but each chapter of the plan has, and then you skip immediately to identification and protection, whereas identification and protection is only one of the methods to affect to the objectives and policies, isn't it?
Identification and protection, I mean, that's talking about from this backstepping and giving you an idea of how things were identified in the past and how they may be identified and protected in the future as a process. And I haven't moved where it's at in the notified version, to be honest. I haven't given it much thought as to whether it was in the right place. I gave it thought as to
what it actually said.
Yeah, yes. And it was said in the 42A, and I took out some of the text.
Mm.
Generally, submitters were quite in favour of having it.
Yes, I'm not saying it shouldn't be there. I'm just saying it shouldn't be in that particular location.
Okay.
I think you might be wise to just spend some time comparing it with other chapters so that the plan is consistent, and I think that section actually sets out methods that are given effect to through rules and other means that probably, and the definitions that are included there, definitions are essentially rules, aren't they? You might like to think about whether some rearrangement of those particular parts is appropriate. your policy 26515, this doesn't mention category 1 items. Is that purposeful?
That's because category 1 items are prohibited.
But they can only be prohibited to give effect to a policy, can't they?
Right. You still need a policy framework to back up the... And in that case, a previous version I had of this item did say potentially to avoid the demolition of Category 1 buildings, or something to that effect.
You might like to look at that. You'd also have to look at scope too.
In terms of the policy, I mean, the rule has been prohibited since 1995. But you still have to look and see.
The other question I've got about that, in little a, it then talks about the relocation beyond the site, and I wonder whether the beyond the site is that what you really mean?
Yeah, there's a role, because there's been a subsequent role which is relocation within the site, so that's the separate role that was introduced as part of the PDP that wasn't there before.
But this is a policy. This is the policy that gives that the rules are supposed to be given effect to.
So this is a separate policy in relation to relocation beyond the site. It's a different policy to relocate if you're looking at relocation within the site.
Where is the policy about relocation within the site?
26.5.1.8. And similarly, the status is less, so the policy should be easier to...
Okay. I wonder if that those two should be clearly linked. It seems a bit disparate at the moment. Anyway, I'll leave you to think about that one. Under 26.5.1.6, at the end, it says applicants will be required to show that the above options will be investigated. 26.5.1.6. Policy. And it says applicants will be... Is that part of the policy, or is that a note? I was unsure what the intention of that...
The intention is that it's a note.
So it's an explanation of the policy, is it?
An advisory note.
That probably should then clearly say that. Just turning over to your walls, tables 1 and 2. And again, it's a matter of consistency with elsewhere in the plan. Generally, they say where the activity status is activity status rather than all heritage features.
Right.
And that's, I mean, it's a minor change, but I think we need to be consistent. And in 26.6.3, where you've got at the end of that discretion is limited to, with an asterisk relating to restrictive. I just wondered if that could be clearer. And stating that when it's a restricted discretionary activity, discretion is restricted too, because I wouldn't want in future years for conceit planners or consultants to take the wrong meaning from that. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom of that page you've got footnotes. Are footnotes the right place to contain the definitions?
Probably not, considering we've actually now added the terms used in this chapter section. That's, you know, the definitions were there in the notified version, and they haven't been submitted on, so I simply left them as they were, but it would make sense to include them either in the role. So I think that one, for example, contributory and non-contributory buildings, would be in the terms used in this chapter, where there's terms that are only
I wonder if footnote 5 is appropriate also as a footnote, because that's actually quite an important rule in itself, isn't it? Because it explains how you give effect to 2663.
Yes, so that should either be within the rule or in terms used in this chapter.
Yes.
Which itself should potentially be in the actual law section.
Now, one question too, and to rule 2665 and rule 2666. Talk about the characteristics being affected. How does one determine what the characteristics are?
I contemplated that as well. I've got familiar with the heritage fabric words. The heritage fabric or characteristics comes from a notified thing, Patty, and I try to retain things where I can. To answer the question, I've included that within the definition of heritage fabric. And essentially, the terms of the chapter heritage fabric four characteristics means, and that doesn't say it's essentially part of the feature contributes to its heritage values. On page 26/7.
26.
I did wonder whether I sort of toyed with the idea of what the characteristics mean, and I thought, well, it's that heritage fabric. My thing might be more the fabric, and the characteristics might be more the gable or the actual architectural
Other characteristics. Something that the inquiry might explain?
Well, it should.
But
on a case by case basis.
But are they part of the fabric? I see.
And that'll help to
physical aspect. Okay.
I think that should be the starting point of everybody's assessment, according to the evaluation criteria, is to look at that where it exists, critique that, and do their own assessment in terms of the verity, etc., and how that will be looked once they've done the resource and once they've done the project and whether it will still be intact.
From memory, there was a submission from memory seeking a conservation plan to be prepared for each application, and I think you apparently didn't agree with that. But I wonder if, in fact, some of the contents of the conservation plan might be appropriate to determine those characteristics.
Yes, it's hard. I mean, I think from my memory, I think the submission might have been in relation to this identification of the teacher, which was it was first worded that that even if you were nominating a building, you needed to a nomination to include a full conservation plan, which is what Heritage New Zealand and others were opposed to. It's just such a huge, resource-hungry thing to require somebody to do. If they're just trying to do it, just simply nominate an item for listing. So that's where that went. Where I recommended, to make it a nice to have, but not mandatory. It's just difficult because the rules do capture so much from something that might simply be adding a sign to a building and a new outside lighting, right through to something that really would justify a conservation plan.
Is it a matter of the activity status could be a determining point?
Mm-hmm. Potentially,
if it's a non-compliant consent, then it's a reason. Or a full discretionary, because presumably a restricted discretionary picks up most of the signage issues, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's an operation.
Yeah.
External operation for category one is discretionary, full discretionary. Yeah. I'm just not sure whether the district plan itself should mandate that a conservation plan is required for non-compliant discretionary activities. We would keep it that an assessment must be, as it's proposed at the moment, done with this evaluation, and leave it sort of case by case to decide what extent of information is required.
That the council doesn't have a dedicated heritage team, and that the consenting planners who might be dealing with this, that these applications may not necessarily have any particular expertise in heritage, would it be useful to provide some guidance in the chapter for those dealing with applications as to how they should be dealt with in that sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what the evaluation criteria and policies, etc., are intended to do, is that they need to look at those evaluation criteria to form the basis of how they form the basis of whether something has been listed, and then they form the basis of an assessment of environmental effects in terms of the heritage effects, and they form the basis of all kinds of processing of the effects. But it is silent on what level of information is required, and it's something that the consent planners did ask when the provisions were being sort of reviewed internally, this version. And what's talk of, there are some things that are really quite minor, and there's a huge body of information available, and it doesn't require a huge amount of heritage input, and there's other areas, other applications where it does involve a huge amount of resource to go into it. So I think we try to provide guidance to the full planner and how they're going to actually process an application. But we haven't gone as far as saying you must provide a conservation plan. Any of them.
Okay. Now looking at your Rule 26.7, dealing with extended place or setting, how does subdivision, or how does one take into effect subdivision effects on those things?
Currently there are specific rules in the subdivision section related to the site that include that contains a listed heritage item. It's full discretionary, I believe. And there are specific policies, I believe, I can look them up if you'd like, relating to the effect on heritage. Whether that goes wrong, I have to consider setting as well, I need to check. Okay. The language there and the submissions on those sort of roles, and but I think for me where they're looking to make less, yeah, more effective.
Just in rule 26.6.18, how do you relocate an archaeological site?
It's relocation affecting an archaeological site.
It's relocation.
So I take that as being...
But the rule doesn't say that. It says any activity that results in an archaeological feature being relocated within the same site.
Yes, I read that to be a feature that exists on an archaeological site, and the feature itself is pre-1900, and the relocation of that within the archaeological site. And that's the sort of thing that doesn't get covered by an authority, because that is only really about the site, from what I understand, not the remains of a mine shaft.
Is the terminology, and is it not an archaeological feature that's been relocated, but a heritage feature?
Potentially, yes. I guess the only thing we need to be clear, regardless of this conversation, is that it's not necessarily a listed feature.
Not necessarily a listed feature, then it can be anything. It's not a heritage feature, it's... it's just... the way it's written at the moment, to be honest, and I didn't mention this before, but my first degree was in archaeology. It's an oxymoron. You can't relocate an archaeological site, because as soon as you do anything to it, you destroy it. And you can't reconstruct an archaeological site.
I think you're right, and I think my interpretation of this rule actually came from Heritage New Zealand, which I'm not asking about, sort of understanding myself and thinking, I think my interpretation is it's a feature that's on an archaeological site.
I can understand if you have an archaeological site and a building on it and you want to remove the building, then the foundation that's being relocated might affect the archaeological site underneath. That I understand. And then the building itself might be a wooden building predating 1900, which would be an archaeological feature. But it may be a building that's from 1905, but would still have the same effect on an archaeological site. But on the other hand, a 1950s building, which is no heritage value at all, could equally have the same value, the same effects on an archaeological site.
Yes, although probably the effects that 1950s building would have would hopefully be sufficiently captured through the authority, because the actual building itself doesn't add anything to the archaeological site.
I'm confused as to what the rule is trying to do.
I think in my mind it is trying to, the little wooden 1900 building that they're trying to move, it's trying to capture that they need consent that, because it may have other effects that aren't dealt with through the authority.
Okay. I'd like you to clarify that quick, please. Turning now to your Section 42A report, on page 36, paragraph 15.15, do Are the design guidelines you refer to in that paragraph, are they incorporated in the plan or some things?
They are by reference.
Right.
My understanding is they were made available at the time of notification. Certainly the Queenstown Town Centre ones were, because I was the author of that.
Now, in paragraph 16.15, we talk about rule 26.6.21 that seems to be a drafting error. I'm just wondering whether the point is sufficiently important that it would be appropriate for us to recommend a variation to correct it.
Well, this is the point that Mr. Vivian also raises in his evidence, and he's of the view, I'm just wondering if you should send submissions on it or something, he's of the view that it is within scope of their submissions to make that change to the rule, and specifically state that the features listed in the statement is looking for the key features to be protected are all captured by that rule. Yeah.
Okay, no, we'll check that.
I think that is quite important.
In 16.17, is that the same point you're talking about?
Yes, it is.
No. Now, just in paragraph 45.46, I'm talking about the incorporation of the term inappropriate. Do you see the point of objectives and policies is to assist us to understand what is appropriate or inappropriate development?
Yeah, I certainly see the policies as serving that purpose.
Do you think the objectives and policies for this chapter do that?
Yes, I do. In terms of the version that's got in front of you now, I think they provide detailed assistance to try and determine whether something's inappropriate or not.
Do you have any questions for me?
No, I'm not. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Jones. You've been most helpful.
Thank you. I'll now turn to Mr. Spencer.
Yes, read the summary of evidence and then answer any questions that you might have. I was initially engaged by the Council from February to April 2015 to review the list of materials, trees, containing individuals who are in the district area, and to provide an assessment of the trees put forward by the public to include this protected tree in the district area. My assessment is carried out using the standard tree evaluation method. This method uses a set of criteria developed for the New Zealand environment. This is a quantitative tool which trees are scored based on varying attributes in the four criteria: condition, ability, motability, and value. As an arborist, I was only concerned with the condition and amenity assessments. The final technical stem score is the sum of all the points in each of the categories. The assessment relies on the objectivity and the experience of the assessor. As a matter of course, when inspecting the trees, I also assess their health, structural condition using the visual tree assessment method. This will allow me to pass on any areas of concerns to council. Several submitters expressed concern over the risk posed by certain trees. Using the quantified tree risk assessment method, I assess these trees and find no cause for concern. In addition, in my opinion, the risk highlighted by the submitters can be further mitigated by tree pruning, which is provided for by way of the rules of Chapter 32. Submissions were made on the definition of the root protection zone. In particular, it was suggested that the root zone of columnar trees should be defined by the extent of the outermost branches plus 2 metres. This is not a method recognised by other local authorities in New Zealand or internationally through research. The PDP uses the drip line method to determine tree root zones, the radius of the root zone of a columnar tree being half the height of the tree. I consider that this method is appropriate when used as a guide for when to engage an arborist or provide specialist advice. Council Parks teams provided a diagram clarifying the drip line for a spreading tree. In my view, the Parks team's diagram is more accurate than the diagram currently contained in the PDP. I recommend that this is included in the chapter and understand that this law has included it in a revised chapter. The frequency of monitoring was also submitted on by the Parks team in regard to limiting the pruning to once per calendar year. I do not believe this is necessary, as pruning more than 10% is a discretionary activity, thus limiting pruning to within tolerable limits of the tree or trees. The Parks team also submitted that works within the root zone of trees greater than 4 metres in height to public places within the Carrotown Residential Historic Management Zone should be a discretionary activity. I agree with this submission as it allows council to appropriately manage and control these types of activities, as works within the root zone of trees can be detrimental to the health of trees not carried out in a horticulturally sensitive manner. In my opinion, items 240, 603, 1002 and 1005 have been correctly included in the schedule 37.8 protected trees district-wide. The Avenue of Spruce and Larch Trees, item 275, located at 343 Arrowtown Lane Case Road, is a significant feature and the stems are scored by these trees to receive protected status.
Okay. First question I have is that you've mentioned various methods that are being used. You refer to the STEM evaluation methods, the BTA methods, and the QDRA methods. To your knowledge, are these used by other district councils? In other words, do they have a general wide acceptance as a means?
Yes, they are. Yeah. Off the top of my head, STEM is used by Wellington. Parts of the whole district plans of Auckland and now the new proposed unitary plan, Dunedin uses it, you know, several other councils use STEM. VTA, visual tree assessment, is a method used by arborists all over the world just to identify defects, potential hazards within trees. And then the QTRA method is an internationally recognised tool for risk assessment specific to trees.
So it's internationally recognised?
Yep.
With trimming of trees, I noticed that under the plan, it's partly a planning question, I suppose. It may not be fair to ask you this, but it's proposed, as I understand, to be a fully discretionary activity. Now, I'm wondering whether that is really necessary, given that it's more an issue, I would have thought, between the council and the owner or owners of the trees concerned.
does it need to go wider than that?
Sorry, you asking if it's necessary?
Yeah, to go from restricted to make it fully discretionary instead of just discretionary, restricted discretionary.
Does it depend on the level of pruning, I suppose?
So it's a concern there that might need to involve third parties, like fully discretionary often involve public notification.
Yes.
Then, you know, it might involve Mrs. Smith, who lives four streets over. She doesn't have to live with the tree, but she says, I want to live up to this.
Yeah, there'd be an interest in pruning. Very often interested with those types of trees, but the level of pruning that occurs, so, yeah.
One question I want to ask, and it's come through some of the submissions, is the vexed issue with wilding trees. Now, as a matter of, are there wilding trees listed for protection?
There are, yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily exclude them from listing.
No.
I was going to ask if there's any wilding trees actually over there in the domain. There could well be, but...
I don't think there is, actually.
Okay.
Well, there are wilding trees, but they're not listed up there.
So when the decision is made to list a tree that's otherwise prohibited to plant, are they sort of trees that where you look at them in a situation where rather than being on a hillside and they can spread for miles, they're sort of a tree that might be in the middle of a, well, near an intersection or on a private property or something like that, where their seeding can be controlled easily?
They've generally been in an urban type environment, so back gardens or places where other activities and crops, in terms of gardening and general maintenance, would get rid of any wilding issues.
Okay. Now you've listed in the trees you've assessed, you seem to have come to a view that the vast majority of cases the listing should remain. I noticed with some trees, one particularly comes to mind was an Arrowtown, where it looks to be on a boundary between two properties. It's a little back street. I don't remember the address of it now. And the tree was right on the boundary, very, very close to a house. It might have been about probably a metre of that from the house. Now, in a situation like that, isn't that going to come as a significant problem for the owner concerned? Because the tree will continue to grow and its root system is going to eventually damage the building, isn't it?
It can cause issues. So the stem assessment doesn't really take that into account, it's just an immediacy evaluation of the tree. I know the tree you're talking about was highlighted that may be a concern.
There's a vacant section next to it, then.
Yeah, someone has invented on it.
Birch's tree.
Yeah, that's tree removal is not necessarily the answer in that situation. Depending on the perspective of the value of the tree against the damage that it may or may not be causing to the neighbouring property, there are things that could be done in terms of foundation work that could allow a tree and a building to exist at the same time.
Are those issues taken account in the risk assessment? Is that what the risk assessment deals with?
That's both tree failure and damage caused by
decay, you might call it, to blow over, that type of thing.
Yes.
Okay. No, that's all the questions I have.
No, I'm not answering. Just on the wilding species issue, if a tree that is a wilding species is protected outside an urban area, does that create a different situation in your mind as to its propensity to become problematic, spreading as a seed source?
It would do. You would need an assessment of the effects of the seed spread, I suppose, as to whether or not that was controllable through the seeds. So whether or not the tree was considered, that actually the particular tree in each situation is a wilding tree.
Mm. In the rural, it was actually in the hearing stream that dealt with wilding trees, which was the rural spring, and dealt with chapter 34, we were presented with a methodology for considering the propensity of a particular tree to be one and to be problematic that could be used. I mean, it was presented in the context of making Pinus radiata a discretionary activity, I think it is, was the suggestion in the district, as opposed to prohibit it. And the suggestion was that that methodology would enable on a discretionary activity to consider the propensity, etc., and the appropriateness. Do you consider that if a protected tree is a wilding species in the rural areas, such an analysis should be done on each of those for consideration before the plan says it's protected?
It would be beneficial to do that to determine whether or not protecting the tree would raise issues in the future. Yes. We don't have to do that.
I know that you weren't asked to consider this, but I mean, you know, I'm just thinking as an arborist, you've got to consider the wildlife.
I'm thinking of situations in my head where that might actually, you might find, I can't think of one, but you might have a tree that's actually just seeding all over the place and it's costing thousands of dollars a year to control that.
Yes.
So
without the study, we don't know whether that's happening or not.
Don't have the information to make the decision.
Thank you very much. Now, just this was a Commissioner Nixon referred to a specific tree in Arrowtown, but it was a matter that on our site visit we were discussing amongst ourselves is in urban areas, is there a point at which trees become too big for the area, for the site they're on? Some species do turn out to be very large trees.
Trees in urban environments are very difficult. It obviously depends on your priorities. You know, do you want to build a house, or are you worried about your house being damaged, or you've got a tree that could potentially be stopping you building, damaging your house, or a variety of other things. It's actually when they get to that size and stature that they have value in the urban environment that we want to protect and maintain.
Precisely.
So it's a difficult situation, and I think council needs to take it on balance as to what's the priority. Is it what? How much are you imposing risk or damage or cost on somebody for having that tree? Does the value of that tree to the community outweigh that risk to the individual or individuals? By way of application, those things can be assessed and council can make a balanced decision once they have all that information that they need to weigh up, I suppose. In terms of, is there a point when trees are too big? No, because it can all be managed with different construction techniques or maintenance of the tree, or it'll be very difficult to put a height or size limit on any tree or any planting that you want people to do, because you wouldn't end up with the big nice trees that people want in Arrowtown.
So just going back to that first part, the balancing the value versus the effect and risk, is that effectively what you've done with your stem and risk analysis?
That particular case, no.
I mean in the general.
Yeah, general, yes. General, yes. If there was a big old tree that looked really nice but it was about to fall over, I wouldn't have recommended it be included or retained.
Yeah.
Well, there wasn't many examples of that.
Now, in your evidence in chief, paragraph, and just in your executive summary, in subparagraph E, you talk about the items that are correctly included. And I'm just wondering why you didn't consider 3573, or maybe you weren't instructed to. And to be clear, 573 is on the lakefront in Wanaka. There are two trees there, submitters seeking them be removed from the list. One is 39 and one is 573, submission.
Right.
That
was the application was removal on the basis that they got
removal consent. Okay, so we can ask you the question on that then, Mr.
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. That answers that question. In paragraph 9.7, we're talking about 275, the trees going up to the Evian homestead. I just wanted to clarify, is it your view that the entire group should be listed?
Yes.
Paragraph 921, in the last sentence, I'm just wondering if you really mean $3, or should that be a different number?
I do mean $3.
Do you?
Yep. It's surprisingly little the amount of money that should be spent to mitigate risk on trees.
Yep. Okay.
If the risk is broadly acceptable, essentially that's a 1 in a million chance that something will happen, or damage or injury will occur. To get to the dollar amount, you divide the statistical value of life by the risk. So it's $3 million in New Zealand, $1 million.
Yeah.
$3.
Okay.
That's not a lot.
No, that's okay. Be clear on that. Thank you. Another question.
I'll just follow on to a question. That's a risk to life, not risk to property damage.
Type you or yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Either.
In that situation, it would have been people, because I always prefer to look at risk to people as opposed to property.
Yeah. Thank you. No further questions? Given that it's 4 minutes for one, we'll be adjourned for lunch and then. Are we going to hear from Mr. Blakey?
Yes, you are. Mr. Blakey is on his way at the moment. We will call him next. The only other option is if Ms. Law reads out her summary between now and one, but I'm happy to adjourn.
I think we might as well just adjourn and reconvene at 2 o'clock.